Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Ukraine's new president inaugurated as world leaders look on and Islamist militants take hostages in Iraq. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington. Ukraine inaugurates Petro Poroshenko as the country's new president today. He immediately offered to hold peaceful dialogues to end a pro-Russian insurgency in the east. Gabe Jossel reports from the capital, where Kiev residents and Ukrainians say they hope the president has what it takes to restore order to the country.
Mr. Poroshenko took the oath of office at the parliament building in central Kiev, officially taking control of a country in crisis. Ukraine's armed forces have been battling a separatist rebellion in two eastern provinces near the Russian border. Mr. Poroshenko offered amnesty to rebels and proposed opening a corridor for Russian mercenaries to leave. I don't want war, the new president said, stressing that he is not seeking revenge, despite the big sacrifices already made by the people of Ukraine during the political crisis and standoff with Russia. Mr. Poroshenko addressed eastern Ukrainians in Russian. He promised a decentralization of power, respect for local communities, as well as new regional elections. Gabe Joselow, VOA News, Kyiv.
NATO's military commander says the alliance must reconsider its force positioning and readiness because of Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region. U.S. Air Force General Philip Breedlove says that for more than a decade, the U.S. and its allies viewed Russia as a partner and must now re-strategize where to position forces and how to deal with the change in its relations. It means the alliance will have to adapt. Police in Iraq say gunmen have stormed a university west of Baghdad and are holding dozens of students hostage. Authorities say the attack took place today at Anbar University in Ramadi. Police say the gunmen killed university guards who tried to stop them at a gate before storming the facility. Security forces have sealed off the area and launched an attack to retake the area and the students. Local officials say flooding in northern Afghanistan has killed more than 50 people and left hundreds missing. Authorities in Baghlan province say that the death toll is likely to climb. The police chief said many women and children are among the victims. Rights groups are condemning the move by Pakistan's media regulator to suspend Jio News, the country's largest news channel, due to a dispute involving the nation's powerful spy agency. The Committee to Protect Journalists, Amnesty International, and Reporters Without Borders all say the decision undermines press freedoms in Pakistan. On Friday, the Pakistan Electronic Media Regulatory Authority said it was immediately suspending Jio's license for 15 days and fining the company $100,000 for committing violations.
So I think it's a huge impact. And it also is a lesson for a lot of other channels and will be used as an example here. And so that the other channels toe the line and possibly lie down completely.
There's more on this story on our website at voanews.com. Vietnam is calling on the United States to take on a larger role in protecting the peace and settling conflicts in the disputed waters of the South China Sea. The Vietnamese call for more U.S. involvement comes as Vietnamese ships continue to fight with Chinese ships near a controversial oil rig that Beijing placed in the disputed waters last month. The social media world is buzzing after one of the world's best-known spy agencies decided it was time to start talking, or rather tweeting. VOA's Jeff Selden has more from the Pentagon on the CIA's public venture into the world of social media.
On Friday afternoon, the silence was broken. An agency long known for stealth and secrecy said hi to the world of social media in a big way. At CIA tweeting, "We can neither confirm nor deny that this is our first tweet." Twitter says within the first hour, those 12 words were retweeted 70,000 times, with that CIA getting 85,200 followers. And then came the jokes. Former Pakistan Ambassador Hussein Haqqani tweeted, "The CIA has followed people for years. Now Tweeple have a chance to follow at CIA." Jeff Selden, VOA News, The Pentagon.
And the U.S. National Archives has released 2,000 pages of documents from former President Bill Clinton's administration, including notes, memos, and speeches that had previously been withheld from public view. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening. It's Saturday, June 7th, and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Frazier. Thanks for joining us.
WFP is concerned about the food security situation and about the possibility of a food catastrophe or even famine developing over the coming year.
The UN World Food Programme warns of looming hunger catastrophe in South Sudan.
It's an approach that helps us manage agricultural systems for food security, but given the changing realities of global warming.
Efforts to address the impact of climate change on rural farming.
The elephants are relatively similar. Numbers fell from 2,700 in the late 70s to about 300 in 2005. And it's been extremely difficult for us to prevent poaching on these few elephants that are left.
And we'll look at the future of Africa's oldest animal protection area, Virunga National Park in eastern Congo. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa.
The World Food Programme warns fighting and lack of access to the displaced in South Sudan are pushing that country towards a hunger catastrophe. The World Food Programme says this humanitarian disaster still can't be prevented, but time is running out. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Before fighting erupted in mid-December between the government and rebels, 140,000 people in South Sudan were suffering from severe food shortages. Now, World Food Programme spokeswoman Elizabeth Beers says that number stands at 1.3 million.
WFP is concerned about the food security situation and about the possibility of a food catastrophe or even famine developing over the coming year. But we can prevent this. If we act now, this disaster can be prevented. This is what I would like to point out. We can prevent, but it's absolutely critical to stop fighting.
But that seems unlikely. A second truce enacted between the warring factions on May 9th broke down not long after it was signed. So the best hope for preventing this food crisis from turning into famine is for aid agencies to get unimpeded access to people affected by conflict. Beers tells VOA it is especially critical to deliver life-saving aid to people in isolated areas. She says this is becoming increasingly difficult because the rainy season started earlier than usual this year. This means aid agencies did not have enough time to pre-position relief supplies needed to help people through the coming difficult months.
60% of the road will be impassable in the next few weeks. That's why the scaling up of our operation is vital, and it's crucial to prevent the most vulnerable to slide into hunger.
The situation is most dire in the conflict-affected states of Jonglei, Unity, and Upper Nile. WFP reports three-quarters of the population in Unity State is short of food, and that is predicted to rise to 85% in the next 3 months. Beers says WFP will be increasing its use of airdrops and airlifts to bring food to these remote areas. But she notes the cost of this air operation is five times as expensive as that of transporting goods by road. She says the agency also is ramping up its efforts to increase food deliveries by river. She says a barge convoy is being loaded with 1,200 metric tons of food in South Sudan's capital city, Juba. She says the barge will set sail in the coming days for the towns of Malakal and Melut with food destined for thousands of refugees and internally displaced people. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A panel discussion organized by the Africa-America Institute, AAI, on the role remittances play in Africa's economic growth has ended. Aminika Junju is the CEO of AAI. I reached her by phone in her New York office to find out more on what was discussed.
A couple of things that came out of this conversation is, first of all, we have to remember that these transactions are personal, they're private, so it's between two family members, you know, one that's maybe living in America and then the person living in Nigeria, Kenya, or wherever on the continent. And so, but however, this very private financial transaction has translated to economic development. So we discussed that reduced poverty. If you took away the opportunity for people to send money home, the situation would be more dire. And so the fact that Africans send over $60 billion to the continent to do a myriad of things, to invest in real estate, to facilitate the education of friends and family, to help people get good medical care. And all of this money goes into the economy and stimulates the economy because, of course, the purchases and the consumption is being done locally.
What did the panel conclude African governments and private institutions can do to help reduce the cost of remittances?
We learned that many African governments do tax money transfer operators. And for some, that tax is actually quite high. And of course, as any business would do, they pass that cost on to the consumer. So if African governments can really look at this tax issue and figure out a way to reduce it, or in some cases, eliminate it, the cost of sending money back home would go down. The other thing, of course, is competition. We talked about this quite a bit. We need more operators in the market for the price to go down. And so some people on the panel said, we need to start businesses. We need to enter the money transfer industry and do that in all the countries and make sure that we try to bring the price down through competition.
Can the African governments individually set up some regulatory things in place to help curb this very serious issue?
Yeah, you know, one thing that was discussed is making it more of a regional activity or even a continent-wide activity, and even going as far as bringing together the AU and having the AU come up with some laws that would bring this down and do it across the board and not just have individual countries act to reduce the cost, but really make it be a continental-wide activity. You know, that came up quite a bit, and people were anxious to see countries come together and decide, you know what, let's bring the price down for Africans. It costs more to send money to the continent than anywhere else in the world. While the rest of the world, the price has come down, it's still quite high on the continent. The other thing that came up is countries have to stop having exclusive contracts with money transfer operators. This is really key. Other countries around the world have done this, and in places where they have stopped these exclusive contracts, many more companies could enter the market and bring down the price. One example that was given was Mexico. Mexico apparently, you know, had several sort of exclusive contracts with money transfer operators, but once they got rid of that, they really brought down the price for Mexicans to send money home. So that's something that we need to consider on the continent.
What was some of the main recommendations made at the end of the panel discussion?
It was said that if we brought down the price by 5%, we could add another $4 billion in the pockets of African immigrants and their families. The other recommendation that came, and, you know, this may be difficult for international money transfer operators to hear, but let's build more local companies to send money, but let's also use more of them, because then, of course, this increases wealth, the ability for people to grow their business, and we're really making sure that local companies' capacity is increased because we're using their services and they're able to hear our thoughts and our feedback about how to improve. The other thing that came up is for African banks to open branches in some of the major cities in the United States and Europe where many African diasporans live. Again, this will make it quite easier for, let's say, someone like me to not only put money into these accounts and then make it accessible to my family who may need it for whatever it is, but also it allows me to really think critically about investments on the continent, job creation, because I have a banking relationship locally, and then that allows me to make investments locally.
Amini Kajunju, Chief Executive Officer of AAI. She spoke with me from her New York office.
The battle farmers across the world face at COP with climate change could spark what's being described as a rural renewal. In a report released Friday, the Food and Agriculture Organization says farmers should shift to what's being called a climate-smart approach to agriculture. The new approach will not only help prevent a future food security crisis, but may also spark economic and agricultural renewal in rural areas where hunger and poverty are most prevalent. UN Radio's Sandra Ferrari asked Leslie Leiper, a senior environmental economist with Food and Agriculture Organization in Rome, what is meant by climate smart?
Climate smart agriculture is a fairly recent approach that was developed by FAO. And it's an approach that helps us manage agricultural systems for food security, but given the changing realities of global warming. So the climate smart agriculture essentially addresses three major objectives: achieving food security through the increase in agricultural productivity and incomes of agricultural producers, incorporating the necessary adaptation that we now know is needed now and also in the near-term future, and also addressing the need for mitigation to have a long-term food security goal to reduce the danger of climate change in the future. So climate smart agriculture is an approach. It involves concepts, it involves development of policy frameworks and technical tools, as well as financing mechanisms to support agriculture for food security under the new realities of global warming.
And why is it important to push forward with this approach to agricultural practices?
Well, I think one of the things we've seen in this project work we're doing is that if we don't try to transition to a more flexible process of identifying what kinds of agricultural technologies will work under the changing conditions of global warming, then you stand to lose, you make a major misallocation of resources. You're investing in the wrong things because things have changed. And what you really need is something that would allow you to have a flexible response to this increased uncertainty, and yet you're investing in something that is no longer valid given the changing circumstances.
How feasible is it to expect governments or those working in these sectors to modify their practices to include climate smart approaches to agriculture and production?
I think it's really feasible if they are involved in the conversation from the beginning and if it addresses what their concerns are. What climate change does is it increases uncertainty. We don't really know what's going to happen. There's much more variability. You can't rely on what's happened in the past as much as you could for what you could do in the future. So that means that people really need to have better access to information, up-to-date information, and they need to have capacity to make flexible decisions and have a range of options. And of course, a really key thing is to build the enabling environment at international levels, which means opening the doors to financing, among other things.
What are some examples that can illustrate the benefits of switching to climate smart methods and technologies?
FAO was funded by the European Community to do a project with three partner countries on building climate smart agricultural capacity. One of the very interesting areas of work there has been in developing an enabling policy framework. It just so happened that one of the countries we're working in simultaneously developed their agriculture and climate change policies. And as part of the Climate Smart Ag approach, we held a dialogue workshop where people that were working on each of those two policies got together and went through it line by line, looking at what was the main objective, what was the time frame, what were the key activities. You know, I think it's important to make the case that climate smart agriculture is not just a new technology that's successfully applied. It's an approach to enabling people to find the right kind of agricultural technological solutions given the changes of climate change, the altered reality of climate change, and to look much more specifically at the kind of barriers to adoption they face. There's a lot of work that's been done on sustainable agricultural technologies. Things like agroforestry, better management of crop residues, introducing rotations, these kinds of things. Restoration of degraded lands. The farmers haven't adopted these practices as much as we would like. And one of the reasons is that it actually takes a few years in some cases to get a positive return. So from when the farmer makes a change to when they get really the benefit, it takes some time. And these are really poor people. They can't wait that kind of length of time. Even if it's only a year, sometimes it's too much. So Climate Smart Agriculture is also aiming to build the financing mechanisms linking to climate finance as well as traditional agricultural finance to address directly that kind of barrier.
That was Leslie Leiper, a senior environmental economist with the Food and Agriculture Organization. She spoke with Sandra Ferrari in Rome.
Up to 37 people, including women and children, were killed in Democratic Republic of Congo's eastern province of South Kivu on Saturday morning in an attack that the regional governor blamed on a dispute over cattle. The victims, who included several pregnant women, had been shot, stabbed, or burned inside their homes. A Reuters cameraman on the scene counted 37 bodies, some of them lying inside a village church. South Kivu, a mountainous region rich in minerals, including gold, is home to members of a tribe who fled neighboring Burundi after the end of a civil war in 2005. The Congolese government has said it plans to target foreign rebels operating in its eastern region after the defeat of the M23 rebel group late last year.
Some people have described the Central Africa as one of the deadliest places in the world. The director of Africa's oldest animal protection area, Virunga National Park in eastern Congo, is Emmanuel Demorodi. He counts the dead by the thousands, gorillas, elephants, hippos, and more than 150 rangers who died defending the park's wildlife. On April 16th, the 53-year-old director was shot three times in the chest and leg by masked gunmen with automatic rifles. Demorodi survived the attack. He vows the park will recover. VOA's William Eagle has the story.
The Howard G. Buffett Foundation recently paid for a $20 million hydroelectric dam in remote Virunga National Park. The U.S. Foundation also gave another sum to hire 200 new rangers to protect the park's gorillas and safeguard a handful of weekly tourists who recently reopened the park in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The help came just in time. Emmanuel Demorodi, the director of Virunga, which is Africa's oldest national park, says thousands of elephants and hippos there have died during 20 years of armed conflict in eastern Congo. Most of the poaching has been done by stateless armed militias he calls terrorists. Over the last 3 years, they've killed 20 rangers and caused the deaths of more than 5 million civilians. They have wrecked the economy of the eastern region of the DRC, where the park's director says the wildlife are a key to regional economic development.
It's been a very difficult period for the wildlife in Virunga. The hippo populations, you know, had a devastating crash in numbers. And the elephants, relatively similar. Numbers fell from 2,700 in the late 70s. To about 300 in 2005. And it's been extremely difficult for us to prevent poaching on these few elephants that are left.
Virunga's hippos are a larger and largely unheralded tragedy in the park. They have neither tusks nor horns. I discovered they can sell the 2-foot-long teeth of the hippo by culling them pieces of an elephant tusk. Demorodi says consumers don't know the difference.
And the hippos are an important example because Virunga used to have the biggest population of hippos in the world. There were 27,000 hippos in Virunga. That's almost 20% of all the world's hippos in the 1970s. This number dropped to about 350 in 2005. So that's a drop of over 99, almost 99%.
Demarode says more than 150 rangers have died protecting the park, 20 in the last 3 years. They are, he says, heroes.
But in considering those numbers, it's also very important to consider the overall devastation that's been caused by the presence of armed militias, but also the sequence of armed conflicts in the last 20 years in eastern Congo, which has provoked the death of over 5 million civilians. And so all of this has to be taken into context as an overall terrible tragedy that's affected the region.
2 decades of conflict may be slowly winding down in eastern Congo. Forces of the DRC last year defeated a major armed insurgency, the M23. They also say they are closing in on the Islamist forces of the ADF Nalu, a militia who are opposed to the Ugandan government. Demarode lists another dozen armed militias who prey on Virunga, such as the Mai Mai and the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda. They're the remnants of the irregular Interahamwe forces that began the Rwandan genocide that led to the deaths of about 800,000 people in 1994. World leaders now talk of a global war against wildlife poaching, which fuels these terrorist activities in Virunga and more than 45 other parks in Africa. Demarode applauds the global meetings, such as the talks in London and Washington, but is skeptical that declarations in remote capitals of the world will produce practical measures in Africa's remote parks.
It's always fascinating to look into the incredible technology that's available today, but until we can get past a situation where a ranger on the ground is, you know, unable to secure, you know, a basic salary that takes him or her above the poverty line and has the training and the ability to prevent them from getting killed by armed militias who are better equipped than they are, then we're not going to solve the problem.
Virunga's plans for the future do, however, mirror the discussions in London and Washington that treat a war on poaching and terrorism as part of an overarching development effort in countries that host the parks, the poachers, and the militias.
It would be a wise approach to address these problems at source, you know, at the heart of the problem. And for there to be armed militias, you need 2 things. One is a fragile state that's unable to uphold the rule of law, and the other is a very strong incentive for these armed militias to form. And, of course, that incentive is tied to the natural wealth in this region, of which the wildlife is a part. So in protecting the wildlife, you're directly strengthening government institutions to uphold the law, and you're also preventing militias from making significant profits from the natural resources in eastern Congo. And so it's a very key part to restoring peace in the region.
The 200 new rangers and a hydroelectric dam on the park's Rutshuru River in Virunga are the launch of economic recovery for the park and the region, says Demarode. He says the park's survival depends in the long term on the well-being of its destitute neighbors. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
Put your flags up in the sky. Hi, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Visit voafootball.com for live updates on the World Cup in Brazil. The site is optimized for your mobile phone or tablet and will bring you the latest scores, stats, photos, and videos. And everything can be shared with your friends from your mobile device to Facebook and Twitter. World Cup nonstop at voafootball.com.
Hello, I'm Kim Lewis.
And I'm Yehiyas Wuhib.
Together we host the Voice of America's informative program, Africa News Tonight.
We present a thorough summary of the day's events, featuring interviews with newsmakers in Africa and the world.
Also, Sunny Young drops in live with sports, and we have features on science, health, and business.
Tune in Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC right here on The Voice of America.
Oh.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa.
And still to come in the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent, and a commentary by Dr. Suleiman Yang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University.
It's now time for our Saturday Music Spot, so sit back, relax, and enjoy.
Avec la participation de Jocelyne Berroa. Hey. Mona Link se kukana
Kacha wa mbenge
chanso nyunyuka iwa samalelu pacha butukwe okutamba mwalelu kutamba nyama mwane tunga mila bichi uyaye wipate
kekele sabroso bolingone sukali nasima bololo eko milokolo sanza apreku boyani. Olingone paradiso nasima eko miafe oko miko banga banga sinte plena suki wana soko bongali na yote koluka libalate oko mona mpasi ya pamba oko mako regrete oko lela lela pamba oko pesa nani pote. Surprise, esa la cama wate, soki ebeti yo fimbo, apre ku papoyo. Olinga moto etumbo, ebande.
Yeah, that's right. That was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. And now the Saturday commentary by Dr. Solomon Nyang, Professor of African Studies and Comparative Politics at Howard University here in Washington. Take it away, Dr. Nyang.
Hello, Africa. Today, the issue of importance to me is related to President Obama's forthcoming White House Summit on Africa, scheduled for August 2014. The growing demand for good governance and democratic rule in Africa is something that demands greater attention. While most of us in the media, in the academy, and elsewhere where foreign policy is discussed, there is a growing demand for the African people to get their leaders going with regard to good governance, human rights, and democratic administration in all the 47 countries scheduled to be here in Washington in August. If you look at good governance, you can see that most of these African governments are struggling very hard to measure up. Some have made significant progress. Others are lacking behind. But if all the 47 nations are going to come to town and air their views among themselves and between them and the leaders of the United States, one other issue that deserves our attention now is the question of terrorism and the manner in which African governments have come together to address the problem of terrorism. There was a lot of news about the Boko Haram in Nigeria. It is still an issue. And of course, the government of Nigeria is still grappling with it. And the U.S. is now intimately involved with what is going on in Nigeria, with consequences for Niger, Cameroon, Mali, Algeria, and a number of other African countries. So the President's Summit is going to deal with the issue of political violence, human rights, and governance. They're all connected. And this is one of the reasons why the Boko Haram issue is not going to disappear. This is why piracy in Somalia and the Indian Ocean would be an issue to be addressed. Religious and political violence in Central Africa is going to be on the agenda as well. In light of this development in Africa, I expect the leadership from the African Union to pay great attention to the question of terrorism and the manner in which the African leaders can come together to come up with a line of action. So as we move from terrorism and the African condition, as we prepare for a summit in August, we must also pay attention to another issue that deserves immediate attention. what is this issue, political ecology, and the agenda for the African summit. Political ecology is widely talked about because it deals with land issues, the relationship between the pastoral elements in African society and the people who are in agriculture. So when we talk about this summit, some attention must be devoted to the land question, land economic development, and the African quest for greater cooperation with the United States in the field of science and technology. How are these issues related? If we look at West Africa, you can see the impact of the desertification process, which led to the collapse of governments in Mali, Modibo Keita's government in 68, and you go all the way up to Eastern Africa, where Emperor Selassie and the people of Ethiopia were caught in a major famine, which in many ways contributed to the collapse of that government. So desertification, which has been ongoing, and Africans have been losing their lands because of the gradual intrusion of the desert into African lands. This does not only affect rains in those parts of Africa, but it affects livelihood. You have a large number of Tuaregs and all the Africans who are very much living in the Sahara Desert kicked out to the cities, even further to the coastal parts of Africa. If you're an anthropologist traveling around West Africa, you will be surprised to see many of these kids in Dakar and many of the Francophone African countries because they came from the north. So when you talk about the political ecology in Africa and the question of land, this issue must be debated because the land issue affects agriculture. The land issue is related to the desertification of African countries, particularly in West Africa. But they have consequences throughout the continent with regard to water. I think the new mantra is water, water, water. In the old 20th narrative, stupid, it is water, water, water. I think the African leaders who are dealing with political ecology as they prepare for the summit must pay close attention to human rights and good governance, but they must also think about the welfare of the average African who needs water for agriculture, who needs water for health, who needs water for survival, because water is going to be a big issue in the continent of Africa. And if there is any area where the Africans are going to make a great contribution, they must look into the equatorial part of Africa, where you have a lot of rain. And if the African governments are fully organized, in partnership with the United States, we can see a new day. And that's the way it is today with regard to Africa and political ecology as we move toward the summit in August.
Dr. Suleiman Nyang with that commentary.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America.
Thank you for joining us tonight. I'm Douglas Mpoga.
And I'm Odette Fraser. Have a good evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Long torn by clan rivalries, stricken by drought and resulting famine, and attacks by a militant extremist group, the East African nation of Somalia nevertheless has made important strides since completing its political transition in 2012. A new federal parliament and speaker were elected, a provisional constitution adopted, a new president elected, and new prime minister and cabinet named. In a nation once synonymous with chaos, there are hopeful signs of improved security and economic growth. Throughout the process, the United States has stood with the Somali people, providing security, governance, and humanitarian assistance to help strengthen democratic institutions and improve stability. Recognizing Somalia's progress, and as a sign of our nation's faith that better times are ahead, President Barack Obama will soon name a U.S. ambassador to serve there, boosting our relations further. Since our embassy closed in 1991 amid the country's then growing instability, a Nairobi-based special representative and supporting staff for many years traveled back and forth to Mogadishu to advance U.S. interests in Somalia. When the new ambassador is named, that system will continue. But as conditions continue to improve, it's envisioned that an embassy will be reestablished in the capital. That will give our diplomats, aid administrators, and other U.S. personnel increased contact with Somalis and Somalia's leaders and oversee continued U.S. support. In announcing the decision, U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs Wendy Sherman cautioned that while Somalia has come far in the last 2 years, many challenges and threats remain. The al-Qaeda-linked terrorists, al-Shabaab, have been weakened, but not defeated. Government services are uneven, and tens of thousands of Somalis remain displaced from their homes by violence. To keep making progress, the pivotal test for Somalia will not be securing more aid from the United States and other international partners, the undersecretary said. Somalis will have to decide for themselves whether they want to exist as a loose community of separate clans, isolated from the world and in conflict with each other, or as a united nation with all the attributes, benefits, and responsibilities that such unity brings.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.